Today is August 5th, 2026. This is your geopolitics briefing from Macro Observer. In the next 8 to 10 minutes, we'll cover why two separate U.S.-Iran ceasefires each collapsed within roughly 8 days, what President Tokayev's on-air rebuke of Vladimir Putin's signals about Russian influence in Central Asia, and how Ukraine's air defenses just hit a record interception rate, even as the Patriot missile stockpile that supplies both theaters runs dangerously thin. Let's start with the number that matters most, 8. That's how many days it took, twice now, for a signed U.S.-Iran agreement to fall apart. The April 8th ceasefire and the June 17th Islamabad Memorandum of Understanding both died the same way, nullified by unilateral IRGC strikes on Gulf shipping, not by any breakdown at the negotiating table. The strategic calculus here is that this isn't really a diplomatic failure in the traditional sense. According to Carnegie Endowment's Rob Malley and Stephen Wertheim, the June memorandum collapsed over irreconcilable readings of who controls the Strait of Hormuz, a waterway that carries roughly 20% of global energy trade. But Malley goes further, attributing part of the failure to what he calls dysfunction inside Trump's own decision-making process, rather than a coherent pressure strategy. Building on that, the deeper problem is structural.
Iran's political negotiators,
Parliament Speaker Ghalibaf among them, simply don't have authority over an IRGC that profits directly, financially and operationally, from contesting shipping through the strait. That means any deal Tehran's civilian leadership signs can be voided almost immediately by military commanders answering to a different set of incentives. It's the kind of dynamic historically seen when national governments negotiate on behalf of semi-autonomous paramilitary forces they don't fully control. The agreement only holds as long as the signatory actually commands the guns. And the guns are active again. By mid-July, CENTCOM had reinstated its naval blockade of Iranian ports and struck targets for 13 consecutive nights before Admiral Brad Cooper reportedly recommended a pause on July 25th. Not because the mission was accomplished, but because Patriot interceptor stockpiles were running low. More importantly, Iranian officials have started floating far more aggressive rhetoric. On July 19th, analyst Mahi Khalizadeh and former Foreign Minister Manoochehr Motaki publicly raised the possibility of an Iranian ground incursion into Kuwait, with roughly 100 American service members taken hostage. That rhetoric landed right alongside a second strike in 2 days on a Kuwaiti desalination and power plant. Prediction markets, for what it's worth, are not buying a full invasion. They price that at just 2.4% by month's end, though they do assign 55% odds to some kind of Iranian military action against a Gulf state. So this looks like coercive signaling rather than an operational plan. But the mere existence of that signaling forces U.S. and allied planners to game out worst-case scenarios, which strains a military that's already stretched. Per Dr. Lucy Barrow-Sudreau of IAS, the Gulf conflict has already pulled U.S. missiles and ships away from the Asia-Pacific, feeding regional perceptions of American unreliability at the exact moment China's defense budget is climbing 6.4% in real terms for 2026. Now let's shift to the other major fault line, Russia's periphery. On July 25th, Kazakhstan's President Tokayev did something no Central Asian leader has done this openly. He rebuked Vladimir Putin on Russian state television at a summit in Omsk. He said he'd received, quote, many signals from Washington and European capitals, questioned the justification for the war outright, and refused to play the role of a Russia-friendly mediator. The strategic calculus here is that this wasn't a private diplomatic cable. It was broadcast. That removes any plausible deniability and signals to other CISTO and Central Asian states that criticizing Moscow now carries less risk than it used to. That's the kind of precedent that can spread quickly. What gives Tokayev the room to do this now is leverage he didn't have before. Kazakhstan's energy sector accounts for over 30% of its GDP and more than 75% of its exports. And it's increasingly exposed to the same Ukrainian strike campaign that's degrading Russian refining capacity, including strikes on the Caspian Pipeline Consortium terminal and the port of Novorossiysk. At the same time, Kazakhstan just signed a $12 billion deal with the EU that includes 50 Airbus jets, and China's Atasu-Xinjiang pipeline is offering Astana a Russia-independent export route. In other words, Kazakhstan has options it didn't have a year ago, and Russia has fewer levers to pull in response. That's because Moscow's own financial position is deteriorating. Analyst Jason J. Smart reports that Russia's third-quarter bond financing target of roughly $16 billion produced only around $112 to $116 million across recent auctions, with two of four auctions canceled outright. Roughly 10% of the federal budget now goes just to servicing debt interest. Smart calls the broader financing model a Ponzi scheme approaching a breaking point before year's end, and notes that Russia's headline 2.2% unemployment rate is really an artifact of military-industrial overemployment, not economic health. Compounding that, a major logistics conglomerate, Wildberries, reportedly owes close to $1 billion to VTB Bank, with roughly a dozen of its 205 facilities damaged by Ukrainian strikes in recent weeks, a platform that some 800,000 Russian businesses depend on. This is the kind of late-stage financial strain that echoes the information distortion of the late Soviet period, when leadership grew isolated from battlefield and economic reality. Putin, per the source material, reportedly meets only 3 to 5 people a day. Meanwhile, on the battlefield, Ukraine just posted its best air defense numbers of the war. On July 30th, Ukrainian forces intercepted 93% of a combined ballistic missile, cruise missile, and drone assault, and over 90% of Shahed-type strike drones across July. Overall, roughly 5,300 of 6,000 total aerial threats destroyed. Former Defense Minister Mikhailo Fedorov has now set an explicit target of 95% across all threat categories. The strategic calculus here is significant. If that 95% target holds, mass Shahed drone strikes stop making economic sense for Russia, since the interceptors cost a couple thousand dollars or less against far pricier Russian drones. That could force Moscow to shift toward ballistic missiles instead, and that's precisely where Ukraine remains exposed, having intercepted just one of 27 missiles in an August 1st strike on Kyiv. More importantly, this creates a resource collision. Roughly 1,430 of the pre-war U.S. Patriot stockpile of about 2,330 missiles have already been consumed across the Middle East campaign. Ukraine and the Gulf Theater are now competing for the same scarce interceptors. Trump announced on July 23rd that Ukraine could license manufacture Patriots domestically, a Raytheon agreement Zelensky confirmed. But within 8 days, at a Camp David cabinet meeting, Trump hedged, calling the technology a hard thing to give away. France, by contrast, has moved more concretely, licensing Scalp missiles, ASIM hammer bombs, and Aster interceptors to Ukraine, a contrast that's reshaping how European capitals rank the reliability of their allies. On the trade front, briefly, the Trump administration, constrained by a Supreme Court ruling limiting emergency tariff powers, has pivoted to explicit statutory authority, a 50% tariff on Canadian autos, spirits, and dairy under a 1930 law that's essentially never been invoked before, alongside new forced labor tariffs and a Senate advanced sanctions bill allowing tariffs up to 500% on Russian imports. CSIS's Scott Miller and Bill Reich note the administration is on firmer legal ground here than with prior emergency measures, even as the pattern of severe announcements followed by walkbacks continues. So what to watch in the next 48 hours? Keep an eye on Kuwait's border. Any confirmed movement of Iranian ground, naval transport, or rotary wing assets toward that border would convert the current hostage rhetoric from signaling into something operational. And given that Kuwait already absorbed direct casualties and infrastructure strikes in July, even a limited buildup there would mark a serious escalation. Prediction markets still call it unlikely, but unlikely is not the same as impossible. And Camp Arif John and Ali al-Salm remain the most exposed pressure points in the entire theater right now. Stay vigilant. Until tomorrow. That's your core brief for today. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow with more.